pants below your knees. signals that it is 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. Tonight we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on a journeys through windows of their soul and transport us to a montage of magical worlds before returning us safely to the present back here in the station. Hi, I'm Harwood Taylor, gallery director at Grimion & Company Fine Art, and I'm also a storyteller. And I'm really excited to be here hosting with my good friend Chris Gorman. We have special guests tonight. It's the gift-giving season, and I think this couple has been a gift to the city of Houston, Wendy Watrous and Fred Baldwin. They are both individually accomplished photojournalists, and many of you know started PhotoFest some 30 years ago. And I don't know, Fred, is there anything else that you would want people to know about you or Wendy?
Well, I'm a late bloomer attempting to be a writer.
Oh, yeah. There is a book that he just got in from New York last night. So thank you again for getting off a plane from New York touring the new book. What's the title of the book?
Dear Mr. Picasso, an illustrated love affair with freedom.
Ah, beautiful. Well, I guess that's a place for us to start. Wendy, before we get into the first story, is there anything you'd like our audience to know about you other than...
I'm a perpetual wanderer of the world. I think that's a good place. I'd like people to know that.
I love that. Well, and I especially appreciate... I had the great fortune of working at this gallery where we hosted the fine art auction preview. And so I was just gifted with hundreds of photographs of the best photographs and by the best photographers in the world. And it was just such a joy to have that. And so thank you for everything that you both have done.
Well, it was a mutual pleasure working with you. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Fred, I guess I understand you met Picasso. You must have.
Well,
can you start with that story?
It's a weird story.
All right.
Actually, I met Picasso, but there's a sort of a prelude to this. I'd had a fairly screwed up life, and got kicked out of a lot of schools, and finally. Tried to resolve it all by, actually did resolve it in a very major way by joining the Marines. And the North Koreans were very helpful, and they came to my rescue by invading South Korea. And so I went off on the first replacement draft and saw a lot of combat in 1950 and 51.
Oh, boy.
But after that, I moved to Paris, and in Paris, I got this crazy idea. I didn't do anything useful in Paris. I want to add that. I just didn't learn French, but I walked around dreaming of a better life that would somehow involve something like Paris. And Picasso became my imaginary father. My own father died when I was 5 years old. And so I went back to the United States and went to college. And my junior year at Columbia, I decided to go and visit my imaginary father.
Wow.
So I took off for France. And actually, just by dint of unscrupulous behavior and lying, cheating, and stealing, the best way to get it forward is in terms of journalism, I have to add.
Okay.
I got his address in Cannes, France. And Villa Californie, and I went to visit him. Well, I pounded on his door, and not with good results. And I did it again, and the results remained the same. For 4 days, I was banging on his door, and actually, I had very little money, so I was sleeping in this little third-hand Hillman Minks car on his doorstep, actually sleeping in the car. And on the fourth day, I realized, you know, I've got to do something. This guy, I've chosen him because he has this amazing capacity to reinvent himself and to become and to change his art, and I've got to do the same thing. I've got to reinvent myself. Yes. And I looked at his drawings. I'd bought a book of his drawings in Paris, and I realized that Picasso had this incredible sense of the ridiculous. I could see it in these monsters that were clutching at these naked women, and he just had something that had a bizarre element to it, but also a great deal of humor to me. So I said, I've got to do something that'll make him laugh. And what is the most ridiculous thing I can possibly do to make him laugh? Because these are mad drawings. So I wrote him a letter. And I said, Dear Monsieur Picasso, in French, I'm sleeping in my car on your doorstep. Then I did the ultimately absurd thing. I didn't know anything about art. I didn't know anything much about Picasso. But I made this an illustrated letter. And I drew a picture of myself sleeping in my car. And then I said, Bientôt je ressemble Moïse. I'm going to look like Moses pretty soon. And I drew a picture of myself on the first day and the second day with this long beard hanging down off my face. And then I said, if you just let me come in and take some pictures, then I'm going to go to Florence where I've got some money. I'm going to shave my beard off. Avec espoir, Fred Baldwin sent this letter in this desperate last moment. I was scared to death because I knew I was making a complete ass of myself. And I was going to embarrass myself for the rest of my life for having done this absurd thing. 2 minutes later, this young woman comes to the door and said, Où est l'Américain? I said, Where's the American? I said, It's me. And I went in. Picasso wanted to see my beard. Except I didn't have a beard. And he pointed this out to me very quickly. And I said, Oh, Monsieur Picasso, said this, I have this imaginary beard. It is very, very long. And he thought that Perfect. Was very funny. And he started laughing. And he said, Well, you can spend the rest of the day here. Okay. So what that moment taught me, I really didn't learn anything much about how to attract all the beautiful women that he did, or how to make the extraordinary art that he did, or how to evolve. But what I did learn was that you have to have a mantra. You have to have a system of operating that started. First of all, you have to have a dream. Then you have to use your imagination. And then after that, you have to overcome your fear. And I had been. I was scared to death. And then finally, the important one, you have to act. And I went back to New York, graduated from Columbia. I had been scared to death about trying to get a job after I graduated from college because I didn't know how to do anything. And I realized after that, with the Picasso mantra that I had taught myself, I could do anything I wanted to do. So I started photography, taught myself, and that kicked it all off. In 1955, when I saw Picasso, and then 56, when I graduated from Columbia.
Beautiful. God, what an inspiring.
Well, it was fun.
Yeah, well, fun and risky, and the imaginary beard is perfect. I mean, especially I'm just thinking of all the etchings where he has, you know, these characters with long beards.
Oh, so yeah.
It was the perfect thing to say.
I think if somebody did that today, it might be like a YouTube prank. You know what I mean? Like the modern day equivalent might be a YouTube prank.
Yeah.
You found a way to get attention and to express yourself. So.
That's a good idea. Maybe I'll have to try that.
You'll have to try it
reinvent
again.
Myself.
Well,
my advanced age.
You could post your photographs on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
definitely you should do that immediately.
Yeah, you have to.
I mean,
I think nearly, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I heard Ann Tucker, you know, someone in the audience said, where are you finding, new talent and so forth? She said, Instagram, immediately. I was like, what's that?
That
what did she
is
say?
The place now that photographer, young photographers, emerging photographers always post Instagram. It's true.
Can you imagine if you had such a venue when you started taking pictures? Wouldn't you have been on there every day, every minute?
I hate to think about that.
There'd be so many photographs out there, wouldn't there?
Well, as it turned out, the photographs I was taking, I didn't know what I was doing. I had borrowed a friend's Rolleiflex. I didn't have any idea. And just by dumb luck, they came out. And then I lost them all. And then I lost the essay that I'd written about this occasion. And about 20 years later, I found them. And now the photographs, I just had an exhibition in Russia of those particular photographs.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Well,
Earth, so
and
beautiful.
You found them thanks to the flood in Houston. Was it Allison?
Yeah, I think it was.
Did they
wash
up
on the doorstep? They washed up one day.
What a message in a bottle. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
well
they looked
played,
much
Chris.
Better than they did originally.
Yeah, they were rather ordinary, but they had changed complexion, and there were strange streaks in them. And so when they were shown at the Manil Collection a few years ago, they looked great.
They did look great. I did see those.
They aged like wine and cheese do.
Well, I'm trying to do the same thing, actually.
But, me too. Me too. That is an awesome story. I mean, wow.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the one thing that you said that caught me on my ear was that you didn't learn how to catch beautiful women, and here you've got Wendy Watrous.
Come on.
I'm not saying I didn't. I said I didn't learn how to do it then.
Okay, no. Then. Later. You honed your skills.
What we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about.
Yes, the New York Times story.
Oh, yeah. Well, Wendy, it's time for you to tell
Yeah, it's your turn. It's your turn. I understand you were involved with the Velvet Revolution of 1968, and that's not a rock band, right?
No. No, it's a very serious political protest, actually. But even
Well, contextualize that, if you would, for us, because Hank always...
I have to go even back. 68 was actually the Prague Spring. And the idea of Dubček, who was the head of Czechoslovakia at that time, was to create socialism with the human face. That's what he actually talked about. And he was unlike any other communist apparatchik that I had ever encountered in my journalistic career. He smiled. He had this warm, intelligent face. And he was a real humanist, you could see from his face. So I was working after I had started off as a reporter for a newspaper. I was working for the predecessor to PBS, which was called PBL in New York, funded by the Ford Foundation and Fred Friendly, for those in your audience who know the history of television. And I wanted to be going to very exciting places. And it seemed to me, with my interest in politics, that going to Czechoslovakia and seeing the beginnings of a major change in sort of political regimes in Central Europe would be the place to go. So I did. I got an assignment. And then because I had done a story on the decriminalization of marijuana, now this was like 65, the station, the program that I was working with wanted to get me out of the country because I was being investigated by the House Commerce Committee and the FBI for the purpose and mission of that particular program, which was to indeed change the laws about the use of marijuana. So they happily sent me abroad, and I spent 3 months in a country that was, in a sense, struggling for its soul. And it was remarkable. Writers would go out to the factories, and they would have these long discussions with workers, and students would be on the trains handing out pamphlets and talking to people, and you really felt the stirrings of this immense humanist change. Until, of course, the Soviet Union said no more, basically. But I went to Bratislava, where the last meeting of all the old communist leaders who met with Dubček and said, this is enough. You know, we don't want you in. We're going to kill this. And they kidnapped him in Moscow. And then there were enormous protests on the streets in Prague. And then the tanks came in. I had just left for Hungary and then Romania because we were going to look at the evolution of socialism. So I didn't get caught up in the tanks. But I went back the next year when a young student did a very un-Slavic thing to do and committed suicide by burning himself to death in the most famous square in Prague. And a New York Times reporter and I got one of the last planes out of Paris to Prague one night, got to the Ruzhny airport, and this very dour police officer looked at us and said, you know, what are you doing here? And we looked and we said, well, we were just trying to see what's happening in the country. And he took our passports, and he took our passports, and he took our passports, and 10 hours later, we were still there. And basically, it was the police and ourselves where they were in the airport. And I had an apple, and I offered the policeman an apple. And believe me, you could not get fresh fruit in most communist countries in Central Europe. And he took the apple. And he said, well, let me see what I can do.
Whoa, the currency.
And about 40 minutes later, he came with the passports and he said, you go, you have 8 hours to the next plane back to Paris. I'm going to keep one of your passports. So you will have to come back. But I'll let you go for these 8 hours. Somehow, we walked out of the airport. It was like midnight. And at the end of the driveway, there was a car. And it was a car with two dissidents in it that somehow knew that we were there. And in the space of 8 hours, we must have met the whole dissident community in Czechoslovakia. We went from one bar to the other. And then when dawn broke, we went to the statue of the famous medieval king, King Wenceslas, and I was able to take pictures of where the student had burned himself to death. And then we went back to the airport and back to Paris. But this all leads up to a very long relationship with Prague. And after Fred and I met, we went to Bulgaria and met five or six very good Czech photographers, went to Czechoslovakia the following year, and developed what was a very exciting exhibition of work that only could be seen under the table. So we spent 3 or 4 months there, basically, got water hosed and were followed and tear gassed and came back to Houston and sent a lot of photo paper to the famous school in Prague and also the photographers that we wanted to exhibit and bring here to Houston in 1990. Well, in 1989, as East Germany began to explode, as Hungary began to explode, then Czechoslovakia began to explode in what was to be the Velvet Revolution.
Wow.
And as you know, they sat, students, families, they sat on the main roads in Prague for over 2.5 weeks and wouldn't move. And finally, the government is sort of semi-collapsed. And in December, Brett and I received this call from one of the photographers who we had sent, to whom we had sent paper and wanted to photograph. And he said, can you be here on December 26th? We looked at each other and said, well, why not? So we did. We got on the plane. We didn't know what he meant, what he was, why. He met us at the airport. And he told us the story of how the paper that we had sent, they had used, and students had used, over the time that the government had cut off all the television, all the radio, all the news outlets. So nobody in Czechoslovakia, except if you were in Prague, knew what was happening. But the students took pictures, and they went at night, developed them on the, with the paper that we sent them.
Wow.
And then went on to the trains at 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. when the workers were coming into the factories and passing out these pictures. So the workers would then take them to other parts of Czechoslovakia and where they lived. And so that paper informed the whole country about what was happening. So he said, now, you don't, I'm not going to tell you where we're going. It was cold and snowy, and we went to this famous pub, this beer pub, and looked around, and there were just probably 40 people there. We sat down, we were issued chairs, and basically we were sitting with the new government, with Václav Havel, the woman who was, Fred was sitting next to the woman who was going to be the ambassador to the United States. And we spent the next three days.
You sat next to Klaus, who was eventually president of Czechoslovakia. Yeah.
And Václav Havel was inaugurated the next day. And Wenceslas Square, where we had been tear gassed and water hosed, was filled with champagne.
Aww.
And the country just came alive
it's
again.
So nice
it was
to get
reborn.
Champagne instead of tear gas materials. Water scattered.
Yeah, tear
it was
gas.
Like seeing the most wonderful miracle happen.
That sounds made up. That sounds like a fable.
Well, it was a fable, and what happened was it got recorded because we had an exhibition based on this work, and they gave us a secret exhibition that our photographer friends had taken of the underground movement with Havel. And Havel did an editorial for the Houston Chronicle, and we did his play at the Alley Theater.
Yes.
Did a play for us that year at the convention center.
Yeah. During Photo Fest.
During Photo Fest.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So
it just gets more
and more
rich.
It was a long
rich.
History. Yes.
I learned a lot from that story. First of all, you're probably running from the law.
Oh, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
And I'm putting an apple in my bag because you don't know if you might need an apple.
Yeah.
Just saying. And my life is super duper boring.
I don't think so if you're telling stories.
I've never been tear gassed at all, ever, which means I'm probably not doing something right. I think.
Well, that's true. You're not protesting in the right place.
Well, that's right.
Apples
right.
are important. I mean, Adam and Eve found that out.
Well, that's true. That's
there's
true.
A long history of people that need the apple. You're right. And you kind of gave those people the apple because you gave them the truth of what was happening in their country by sending them that paper so they could disseminate it to the country, right?
So all those things keep moving. I mean, if you send a sort of creative tool, it doesn't die. It keeps growing and moving and
going
places.
That's a good story. That's a good story. I like that.
I'll never forget that. I mean, it kind of reminds me of Slumdog Millionaire, like all these, you know, random things that, I'll never need this. And it's like, the very thing you need happens to be one apple.
I have the apple. I brought it.
There you go.
That's a really great story. Plus, I also learned that Prague has always been cool. You know, I thought it was just recently cool. It's been cool.
Oh, no. It's been cool
the whole time.
Yes.
Was not aware, but
so,
now I know.
And I wanted to, I really appreciated your telling me, Fred, how you became a photographer. And I wanted to know your journey just a little bit. and then we can go back to the story that you were going to start until you insisted Wendy tell her story. And then I want to hear about how Wendy was a spy once.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Well, so, actually, I wanted to be a writer. But then I realized that my Olivetti typewriter didn't have spell check.
Okay.
And I don't know how to spell, so I became a photographer.
Good for you.
So I went down to Savannah, Georgia, because I couldn't survive in New York, and had a place to stay there, and started photographing children, actually. But the big breakthrough in terms of changing my point of view was when I decided that I wanted really to try to be a documentary photographer, like the photographers who I admired so much, Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange. And I wanted to be somebody who got out and got mixed up with very interesting parts of life and different aspects of seeing things. So I went out to photograph a tobacco auction, but I never got there because on the way out in the middle of Georgia, I saw lined up on the side of this little road that I was driving on a line of cars, and they're all being decorated. White supremacy forever, KKK.
Oh, ouch.
So I stopped, and it was a toss-up. Was I going to try to sneak some pictures with a telephoto lens in the bushes? And I decided no. I had the Picasso mantra, and I was going to do something, even if it was going to scare me after death. So dragging one foot after the other, I went up to the meanest-looking one there, and I said, you suppose I could take some pictures, y'all? And they said, you with Time Magazine? I said, no, sir. I said, well, I guess it'd be all right. I spent a day and the night with the Klan, and I didn't take many photographs. But what this did was to break me into a whole way of thinking that I was very afraid of, that I hated. The Klan represented people that I despised, and they were really the worst. But during that short period, I actually had a chance to talk to some of the men and women, not the leaders, not the preacher who was the
sure.
Grand Mufti. And it turned out that they weren't as nearly as scary as I thought they would be. What their problem was, they were poor and they were exploited like everybody else who lived on a farm that didn't grow very much stuff. And the only thing that they had going for them was the fact that they were white. Mm. And I began to have began to sort of work into my thinking that in spite of it being the Klan, it wasn't quite the way I thought it was. And so then I unfortunately did not follow through on that. I went up to New York to show Museum of Modern Art and Magnum Photography my work to see what they thought of it. And I made a huge mistake. I never showed them the Klan work. I didn't think it was any good. And
wow.
Had I shown my Klan work to Magnum, they would have said, go spend a year with them. Get
right.
the story down. And I probably would have become a Magnum photographer.
Yeah.
Now, MoMA bought one of my children's prints, which is very nice, but that was a huge mistake on my part. Well, I took off for Europe and started a crazy, crazy lifestyle, photographing reindeer herders and underwater activities, and I polar bears eventually, and a lot of nutty stuff. But
yeah,
we'll get back to Wendy.
Okay. Before we do that, let's have Tatiana tell us a little bit about storytelling in Houston, because this is Christy Gorman, and this is Harwood Taylor.
Hey, hey.
And we're listening to our guest storytellers, Fred.
Fred Baldwin. And
Wendy.
Wendy Watrous. Yes.
And this is So What's Your Story, only on Pacifica, KPFT 90.1 Houston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Tatiana, tell us about storytelling, please.
So, you know, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because, you know, it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, and that's located at 1500 Sunset. There won't be a swap in December, though, because the fourth Tuesday is Christmas Eve. But do plan to join the guild for their first swap of 2020 on January 28th. And make sure to bring a friend. And be sure to visit the guild's website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events. And while you're on the guild's webpage, why not become a member? You can do it online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under Radio Program. And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem, because you can listen to us stream live on KPFT.org and Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube. I guess you can say we're all over the place. We'd also like to suggest program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And be sure to share it with your friends. And we love it if you like us when you leave. You got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Next one is January 14th, and the theme is adventures. And for our listeners out there who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both also happen to be staunch supporters of our program. Harwood, Chris, back to you.
All right. Well, I was fumbling through my phone to try and find a Wimberley Storytelling Festival jingle that they've made, and it is so darling. And while someone's telling a story, that's what I'll be doing. But
jingling.
Well, you know, looking through a little bit. But Wendy, I wanted to hear. Thank you. By the way, my God, that is so frightening. Just the idea of walking up to a Klansman in any era, but in that part of the country at that time, as a young person, you know, armed with a camera. I mean, yikes. And thank you for that. Maybe that'll come with me the next time I have some challenge to meet.
He's tall and has a good Southern accent, so that helps.
Yeah, let me hear it. Are you from the Time Magazine or Life Magazine, son?
Well, I'll tell you. it just depends where I am.
I see. All right. Well, we're from Texas. Wendy, I want to know about...
God.
I want to know how you became a photographer, a photojournalist.
Well, one thing for sure I knew by the time I was 13 years old, that I didn't want to have the life that most women I knew had. I wanted to venture out, do the kind of things that men did, and not necessarily have children or a family. I wanted to experience life. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the yearbook of my high school years, where they had, you know, these sayings for everybody. So mine was, I want to sail forbidden seas and land on barbarous coasts.
Oh, my God, and it's just what you did.
That's the best one ever. I've never even heard that one.
There are many people that don't know, but Wendy was a war correspondent for Newsweek and Time,
yes?
That's
right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty barbarous coast.
That's a barbarous coast.
Well, my family, of course, were just horrified.
I'm horrified.
But I started as a newspaper reporter. I probably would have gone into the Foreign Service had it not been the 60s, but I was so mad about what we were doing in Vietnam and other places that basically I wanted to report on it and tell people and share with the world. Well, and so that's what I did.
Well, I'm so glad that's what you did, and this is where we are, and then I get to hear this firsthand in the room with you. I want to know about how I understand you were a spy once. You never... I guess that's what
I have to go back actually to Central Europe and Czechoslovakia again. I was living in Vienna.
Okay.
And I was stringing for the New York Times and for Newsweek, both writing and taking pictures. And I had been in Czechoslovakia doing some reporting on writers and the beginnings of a new sort of movement for dissent in the 70s. And there was a very famous writer, underground writer, Czech writer, not in the 70s. It was just shortly after, actually, the Warsaw Pact invasion. So it was late 60s, beginning of 70s. And he had escaped to Vienna, and he and I knew each other, and he knew that I was getting in and out of Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. He also knew that the Soviets had begun secret trials of Czech dissidents and people that had supported Dubček in the Prague Spring. But none of the international news people knew anything about it. So he asked me if I would go in and carry back some papers that underground people in Prague had put together about the trials. And I said, sure, I would. And I was driving a little red Fiat, and it would take sort of an hour and a half between Vienna and Prague. And I went in, a short kind of reporting assignment to do. And then I followed the instructions. And I went up to the famous library near the castle, near the Hradčany castle. You go across the Vltava and go up the hill in the old parts of Prague around the winding streets. And you see what was an old castle that is now a 7-story old library. It's really beautiful, sort of a Baroque library. So parked sort of off to the right and went into the library and was sort of looking around at the stacks. And somebody came over and said, what are you doing here? What do you want? And I said, well, I'm looking for Jan. And then she left. And I was looking around, and I went towards a door in the back of the first floor with these Baroque columns. And the door opened, and I went back into the stacks, following a young man way, way, way back into the kind of the subterranean dark parts of the, and he handed me a sheaf of papers. And I put them under my coat because it was very cold at the time. Prague in winter is very, very cold. And went out and continued to look at the stacks and slowly made my way to the front door again. And the woman who had come up to me, nodded, and I went through and I left. Got in my car. There was nowhere really to hide the papers except under the seat in the back seat. I mean, Fiats are badly built and they're small, and you can get in anything. So I started out, and it started to snow, and it started to snow really heavily. And it was, you know, gray, black, dark. And the road to Prague is nothing but woods once you leave the city.
The road to Vienna?
The road to Vienna, yeah. And the snow got heavier and heavier. I didn't have snow tires on. And, of course, the roads were not being cleared. I mean, I was in the middle of nowhere. And then I saw behind me these headlights. Ugh. And they were the headlights of the Tatra cars. And Tatra cars look like sharks, like black sharks. And they are the car of the NKVD and the KGB and so forth. And that car stayed behind. It took, instead of 1 hour, 1 hour and 40 minutes, it took 4.5 hours. Because I couldn't go very fast with the snow. And it was hard to see. And that car never left my... I mean, it could have passed me very easily. They're very strong cars with Porsche motors in them.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I could just disappear out here. I mean, then nobody would ever see me again. And nobody would ever know anything. Of course, I couldn't tell anybody where I was going, obviously. And it just stayed about a car's length behind me. It never came closer. It never veered away and the whole time. And then finally, I was feeling so desperate. I saw the border lights. And I passed the Czech border and then crossed the line into Austria. And I just got out of the car. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I felt like freedom suddenly.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
that car turned around.
Oh, that's really horrifying. That's okay. The best part of the story right there.
Okay, I'm casting the movie of this, first
right.
of all.
Okay.
And then I'm going to use his phone and buy some tickets to Prague. You're kind of selling Prague right now.
Oh, yeah.
I'll need more
clothes.
Oh,
it's beautiful. Just don't go during tourist times.
Or spy season.
Now is a perfect time to go. Because
I'm not going in spy season.
Prague, it's just beautiful.
You're selling Prague right now. I'm just saying, we need to call the Tourism Commission. Prague rocks. I'm so glad you're okay. That's horrible. Know. Who knows what could have happened?
If something had happened, you would never have known.
What was in the papers? Did you read the papers?
They were documents about the trial. Somebody had gone, you know, those people that have remarkable memories.
She's one of them.
And the story broke in the New York Times a week later.
Wow.
Oh, it got it to the Times. Because he had connections everywhere in Le Monde.
We're going to need to cast the movie, get to work. You can use Instagram. Pick who's playing you. You need
after
to pick
you get somebody younger and better looking.
There's so many people that can
oh,
play.
Oh, come
you.
On.
Someone doesn't think that's true. So, there you go.
Well, no, not only that. How could you possibly not have been absolutely stunningly beautiful and which you carry for to this day? Or why would I have picked a...
You know, that's true. After
oh
Picasso.
I know.
That's what taught me what to
God,
be looking
Fred's
for.
Pictures of Picasso. I mean, here's a man of 76. He looks like
he's
45.
I mean,
unbelievable.
Viagra?
This is pre-Viagra.
I don't know, whatever.
French
I'm not
Viagra.
Sure what it was. It was working
but, you know,
well.
Nobody believed that we would start Photo Fest. It was the first in the United States, and that it would survive 30
tell us,
years.
Tell us how you started this Photo Fest that
so,
I've been well, to.
So
many
we've
times.
Got, we've right. got, we've got a. Just I'm just giving you a little time window. So we've got about I don't know what
10 minutes.
Yeah. So
oh my God,
can you do the history of Photo Fest in 10 minutes?
I can
go
begin
go.
The history.
Okay, okay, good.
Just do the first.
Yeah. First of all,
85.
First of all. This was a great idea. It was a French idea originally. The month of photography in Paris and the Rencontre, the portfolio review that is available in Arles in the south of France, tipped us off. We went down, had our portfolio review. Wendy won the Oscar Barnack and the World Press Awards for her work on Agent Orange that she did for Life magazine.
Whoa.
And so we went down to collect... have some fun after she, Prince Bernhardt, gave her this award and went to Arles and had a blast. It was fun. We sold some work and so forth and so on. But we got the idea of doing the same thing in Houston. Now, we moved to Houston in 1980 and we incorporated PhotoFest in 1983. We didn't have any money. We didn't really know anybody. And so how do you start a... million-dollar organization with no money when you don't know anybody? Well, the way you do it is you move to Houston, where the prevailing thought is if you go out and stick a hole in the ground and then you do it again and then spend another $1 million, and you do it enough times, eventually you're going to get totally broke or you're going to get very, very rich.
So
we knew that this kind of spirit of entrepreneurialism here. So we decided to do something that was absolutely amazing and ridiculous. We invited three friends from
four,
four friends. Okay. We knew all the photography community from all over the world from our own work.
Okay.
And so we invited a man named Franco Fontana from Italy, Iko Narahara from Japan, Bill Klein from Paris, and then Helmut Newton from Monaco. And we invited them to Houston, paid their way over here, so that they could photograph the rodeo and the livestock show.
Oh, this is genius.
They had never seen a rodeo before.
It's exotic.
Well, it wasn't as exotic as Helmut Newton was.
Nothing is.
And when he hit town, Houston society went crazy. And we just followed him around, the television cameras and the journalists and Helmut, to all the...
Everybody gave a party.
The nicest homes in River Oaks. Mm-hmm. And we started... That's when the money started trickling in. And that's how we kicked off the first Photo Fest.
Smart.
Put Photo Fest on the map.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's really thanks to entrepreneurialism and the big spirit of Houston that I think we were able to survive for so long. And we did things that nobody else was doing. A very prominent person in the art world said, well, you should do Ansel Adams and, nature photographers. And we said, no, we are going to find new talent and people from all over the world that haven't come to the United States and haven't been seen, and we're going to do new things. And it's worked 30 years, and it's one of the best in the world.
It really is. It's phenomenal. I think of just having two cats and a dog and how complex my life is, and I think that you and Stephen Evans, your new director, who I adore and think is doing a fabulous job, although I look at a distance, you're just your whole team, Vinod, and all of everyone I meet from Photo Fest, and they stay for so long.
They do.
It's a passion.
They come to work as volunteers from the University of Houston and Rice.
Right.
And they stay because it's exciting. The idea, not that they're going to get rich.
No, I know that.
But the ideas are exciting.
Sure they are.
Well, they are.
Also, to use the two cats and a dog analogy, what you need is two lions, a tiger, a giraffe, and maybe a couple of boar constrictors, just to give people a little surprise.
And some wildcat or money.
So the one coming up in March in 2020 is going to be work from Africa, all over Africa, north to south, and it'll be very, very exciting.
I'm excited already. I went to some exhibitions recently. I think it was Danish.
Yes.
Photography.
Yeah.
And I'm half Danish, and I just kind of wanted to experience, people maybe that came from there. My grandma used to always go to Denmark. And they just had one woman who just took pictures of the outside of homes.
Yes. Yeah.
And the outside of roads. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating. And I didn't think I was going to like that. And I heard her artist talk, and I was like, I need to look at more of these. I was there a whole afternoon, and I was very engaged. It was really great. So thank you for bringing people like that to town so that someone who doesn't have a passport can experience things they may never see.
That's the idea.
Yeah. Well, that's me.
These people are so amazed by Houston. I mean, we've worked in over 60 countries since we started Photo Fest, and China, Russia, Japan, Korea, South America, almost every country in South America, the Middle East, now Africa, and it's Russia, Europe, you name it. And we're a little bit like a dog. You want to sniff in every hole to see what's there. And this is marvelous to be able to do that with photography. Mm-hmm. And so we have done that. And as a result, we've had some pretty amazing things happen. You talk about some of the things that Latin America. Now, Wendy speaks fluent Spanish, which doesn't hurt, and fluent French. And I speak pretty good English.
I've heard you do it. You're awesome at it.
Well, not great, but I mean, working on it.
We better watch the time.
I know. We are watching the time.
We are watching the time.
Well, that's our job. But, I was thinking about y'all and just you know, you're the kind of people that change the world. You really do. One person can, and you know, just
you
sending
can
those
parts of it.
You change parts of it. But you change minds and hearts very quickly with the exposure that you've given us in Houston. I feel really grateful that I came. You know, that I grew up here, and that, you know, thankfully Kimberly Grimion was such a champion of you guys, and you know, introduced me to y'all, I was amazed that you would do this, and I'm really glad that we were able to get you here.
Oh, Fred, well, tell us.
We need
about
to do
your...
another hour another time.
Oh, I want to hear about Fred's book briefly.
Well, yeah, we should.
Well,
do that.
After 10 years, Wendy let me take off my duties at PhotoFest for about 10 years. Well, she ran everything, and she probably would have anyway. So I wrote a book, and which is about my life, and it actually stops after we meet. So it's the first. It's really all these crazy stories on how I managed to survive, and it goes
well,
all over
the high Arctic.
Well, and a
in
lot
the,
of work. We, I was fascinated. I was fascinated with the Arctic and also
Me
India
too.
And Afghanistan. And I was a Peace Corps director for a couple of years in Borneo. And travel in the world has been something that's been very important to me. So
I read that you were the first person to photograph a polar bear underwater.
Yeah.
There was a whole line of people that really wanted to do it, but you forced yourself to the head of the line.
Well, that... did the same thing with Marlin and almost got killed doing it, and an homage to Hemingway. But a lot of these crazy stories. But really, a story that really sums up what PhotoFest means. We recently, a dear, dear friend of ours who is a Japanese critic named Tatsuo Fukushima died, and I heard from his daughter, and she sent me some pictures of his funeral. And on the funeral pyre in Tokyo, on the top of the whole thing, was a cowboy hat that we had given him in Houston. And Houston experience meant enough to that man and to his family, so they put a cowboy hat on his funeral pyre, on the altar.
Wow. How beautiful.
So that's Houston.
How beautiful.
That's
how
beautiful.
Well,
and
that...
we can all be a part of that. We are a part of that because we welcome people from everywhere. We want everyone to come. Please
that's
come.
That's right.
We love Houston. Come on and visit
we
us.
We want people.
Yeah, visit us, please.
So
it's a great city.
It is.
Indeed.
It is. It is.
Indeed.
And we live in the best part. We live right there by the Manila.
I know.
Gosh.
I know we do.
So who were the storytellers in your homes? Because you both are gifted storytellers. Fred, do you remember a storyteller in your home? Was it your dad or mom?
It was my mother. She was telling me my entire life how important my family was and how aristocratic we were.
That's
great. And what that was very helpful because that generated a rebellion that launched me in the right direction.
I love
no one
that.
Ever did that at my house. Just being clear. We knew that wasn't us. Who was your storyteller person?
Actually, it was an uncle who was in the OSS, and then he went into the CIA. And he was just sort of in there long enough to be able to actually tell stories. Unfortunately, he was one of the initiators of the Bay of Pigs. But other than that,
he was a great guy.
Oops.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's an oops.
Well, we always have a rule.
Yeah, we all have foibles.
But he could tell stories very well. And he spoke 4 or 5 languages, so he could intersperse the stories with,
I liked when Fred was doing that earlier with a little bit of French.
Around the world.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
the French
yes.
was dope. That was dope earlier.
But you know what? I've learned from Fred, too, actually.
It's
God. One of the things that have really kept us together, his sense of humor and his ability to tell a story.
Well, not only that. This won't take very long.
We got time for you.
Okay.
Hurry up, Fred.
When we had a friend who we met who asked Wendy and me this very obvious question, how did you two meet? And this guy worked for the New York Times. And so I told him this story. I said, well, we met in New York at this Italian Duchess's cocktail party. And Wendy was wearing this little poochy, short little poochy skirt. And she was the sexiest thing I had ever seen.
What?
And we got together and we had oh my God, we had such a romance. And it went on, and the story went on and on.
Okay, we have a full another hour. Will y'all come back?
I have to finish the story.
Okay.
Let him finish his story, please.
Oh, you can't trust the press. 11 days later, this appeared in the New York Times.
No,
story.
That was supposed to be off the record.
The online version.
Yeah.
That was off the record.
Okay, so we want to just thank you. We had Fred Baldwin and Wendy Watrous here for the hour, and what a treat it was. I know things about you that I didn't know. And Chris Gorman, it's always great to have you as my guest co-host.
I'll help steer the boat. Yep.
Don't forget our friends at the Moth Warehouse.
That is not what we're
supposed to be saying.
What we're going to do is not move because Lars is up next.
Thank you, Chris.
With a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. You need to make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, as Tatiana would say. And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Chris.
And Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana, and Justin, and Hank.
And Hank.
And Wendy, and Fred.
And Fred.
Thank you.
And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Yeah. Peace. Yeah. And cheers to all.
Cheers. Indeed. Happy Christmas.
Yes. Happy holidays.
Holidays.
The difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest, all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul, you know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine. What I'm calling the Shock Doctrine is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Helping out at KPFT isn't all meetings and telephones.
One committee works your brain and your body.
And we don't mean throwing things at each other.
The building committee handles structural improvements to KPFT.
From new shelving to sheetrocking to a wheelchair access ramp, the building committee makes a difference in what's on the air by keeping KPFT studios in shape.
We're a committee composed of volunteers who care about KPFT, and we're happy to get our hands dirty to help the station.
Workdays are conveniently scheduled on weekends, and you'll get to meet lots of fellow listeners, have oodles of fun, and make a difference.
So what are you waiting for? Put your hands to work helping your community radio station.
Call 713-526-4000 for more information about KPFT's building committee.
We meet regularly at the studio, 419 Lovett Boulevard.
Don't forget to wear some work clothes and a smile. Yeah, don't come naked.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio.
Commercial-free and listener-sponsored.
KPFT.